During Memorial Day at Lowe's, shop household must-haves for less. Save $80 on a Charbroil Performance Series 4-Burner Grill to chef up something special. Plus, get up to 45% off select major appliances to keep things fresh. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/27. While supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
Yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
What's up, Foos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
I've been wanting to talk about this element of this new Koberger book for a while. The new book is out, by the way. You may have heard of it. I'm not even going to say the title of it because I think it's a waste of time, and I think it's not a book worth reading because a lot of it is focusing on debunked DNA claims and crime scene forensics that are easily disprovable. It very much does feel like a cash grab, in my opinion. But buried inside it is something far more unsettling than almost nobody is talking about. Brian Koberger's own words from jail. Three letters written from the Lehigh County Jail in October of 2023 addressed to his dog, his sister, and his family, published for the first time. And we're going to read each and every letter here on the program today and break it down. Because when you read them alongside what his mother told the FBI the night of his arrest and what two inmates independently observed about his behavior, the psychological portrait is unlike anything we've seen in this case. Psychotherapist Siobhan Scott, author of The Minds of Mass Killers and her memoir Nightbird, which is available right now wherever books are sold, is joining us to help break this down. When I first saw these letters, Siobhan, I was like, woo, we got to talk to Siobhan about this. This is interesting. And then I emailed you and Robin right away to let you know we're talking about this. Let's just kind of dive in here to it. On October 9th, 2023, 10 months into facing the death penalty for four murders. I think it's important to understand the timetable at which these were created. So he's in jail at this moment. Brian Koberger writes a letter to his dog. The full text of the dog letter. Here we go. Dear Scout, earlier you and I, unbeknownst to you, communicated. I have no doubt that your heart was conscious of what I intended. Always of your pack, brother. Brian C. Koberger. Signs his full legal name to a letter addressed to a dog. Claims they communicated telepathically. That's the whole letter. He calls himself the dog's pack brother. No mention of the victims, no charges or a situation. What does it tell you when a man facing execution is writing letters like this one, Siobhan?
Well, frankly, I had to hold my head for a minute. You know, this is
going to explode.
You know, we can have certain categories of people who commit murder and commit mass murder, and this kind of defies a category. I mean, you've got a real unique individual here, and this speaks of somebody who's disconnected from reality. It's got a psychotic quality to it, and now we can't say is he truly psychotic. We don't have any evidence of that. We've not heard about auditory hallucinations or fixed delusions. I mean, there's a lot of other things we can say, but nothing that looks like classic schizophrenia. But it does make me think, is he on the schizophrenic spectrum to some degree? Or is he developing a psychotic disorder like that? Because this is really weird. And yes, my red flag went up too. It's like, what in the world?
Yeah, that word developing is really interesting, Siobhan, because in his isolation that he's in right now and in such great suffering that I'm glad he's going through, can a psychotic development happen in that kind of situation?
If somebody was prone to it, and we can certainly say there was a lot wrong with his brain, so he has a fragile brain, you can say, could isolation and stress contribute to a psychotic break? It sure could. But, you know, a lot of people were speculating, and I think even his attorney, they were going with, you know, he's autistic, and I think that was an attempt to gain sympathy for him. And he does have the odd social way of being in the world. He doesn't connect with people in a normal way socially, which can sound autistic. But autistic people, that's not associated with cold-blooded, you know, murder and the other psychopathic traits that we see with him. So I'm looking more now, you know, if I had to guess, make some guesses about what could be going on, and that's all I'm doing is guessing, something more on the schizophrenic spectrum or personality traits, like there's schizoid personality, which can superficially look like autism because these are people that are socially isolated. They don't react to people normally, and they're very unusual. And schizotypal, which is in the same category in the DSM manual, and that's a person who can have some psychotic-like qualities. And so I'm looking again at personality development with him, and you've got a real mix of very unfortunate traits.
I'm also curious, Siobhan, what really kind of struck me about these, because other serial killers like Dennis Rader and not serial killers necessarily in terms of Ted Kaczynski, but a serial murderer, they actually had kind of similar writings with this weird pontificating and grandiose language. And we know that Koberger, to a large extent, a lot of it was copycatted from other things he had studied. At least that's the appearance it has. He never admitted it. Do you think these letters were actually who he is and how he's trying to communicate, or is this a copycat attempt? And I'll add one thing on that. I did research it. None of these people actually ever try to communicate with their pets. There's been no...
Right.
So that makes it a kind of stand-up. Right. But what about all the other stuff? Do you think copycat or original?
It could go either way. I mean, who knows, right? Without spending time sitting down and talking to him, I think then you would get a better sense of the guy. But, and certainly psychological testing would help and be called for here. But the letter to the dog was bizarre enough that that's what made me start to think psychotic-like, because it was just, the language was weird. Not like, you know, I tried to imagine writing my dog a letter and it would be, Ridley, you're such a sweet boy. I love you. I mean, you know, it's like the kind of things you say to your dog.
But he kind of wrote it the same way he wrote it to his sister and his family, though. So is he viewing it all the one same?
Yeah, his way of connecting. This is a very bizarre way of trying to connect.
I mean, there seems to be an ongoing theme, and we're going to go to our next letter here. He wrote to his sister, and that ongoing theme seems to be telepathic communication. Dear Amandas, he's with an S, in the abstract sense and via intuitive capacities, the August effect can be analyzed in the gravitation of heart's promise unto the green pastures ahead, always in your heart burns Brian C. Koberger. He addresses her in plural, the August effect, capitalized, is like a proper concept. There's no personal warmth here, zero reference to their actual relationship, zero acknowledgement that he's in a jail cell. What, I mean, did they miss an opportunity here of not looking at his competency before going as far as almost walking up to trial? Because I don't know, the letter to the dog, this one, I would think if you're the attorney and you're intercepting these through the jail mail system, I might be going, maybe it's time for a competency hearing. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah. And it could be that he hides this stuff pretty effectively.
Yeah.
So people that, you know, are just speaking to him normally, I mean, they may see that he's eccentric and odd and doesn't connect in the way normal people do. But they may not see this hidden stuff that apparently a lot of people weren't aware of. But it definitely paints the picture of someone who's in a different psychological universe than the rest of us.
Yeah, I'm curious your thoughts also, Siobhan. He seems, boy, I'm throwing my way back memory on all these things that were covering him during the case. A lot of his anchoring he was doing, apparently, I think, from his life, emotional anchoring to the limited extent he had, was with his mother. And he did always think about his dog. And I wonder also, is this psychological break that looks like it might be happening again, third party? We don't know. We're not in there with him. But without those emotional anchors, is this what starts happening to the brain in that isolation? Because again, you know, the first thing that pops in my mind is the horrendous things and going on with Richard Allen when he's in isolation from Delphi.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we could be dealing with the same thing here, or similar, at least one's innocent and the other's guilty.
Right, right. Yeah, you've got some similarities with the breakdown of what is reality here. And was Koberger functioning this way all along and hiding it, or is this something new? That's where it would be interesting to look at letters or things he's written from the past. I mean, he would be a fascinating one to evaluate and look over everything he'd written over the years. And was there, a shift in the way he was communicating.
I'm sorry, the hypothetical with the emotional anchor of the mother, let's say that's it. Again, just doing a thought experiment. So he's doesn't have the emotional anchor, which was kind of keeping him from going down this dark road of schizo in some way, right? Is there something, like if they put him back in general population rather than isolation, do you think it might, I mean, it just, again, I know it's massive hypotheses going on here. Would it re-regulate him, do you think, or someone like him, or is it starting to go down too far? Or is it only that one person that can provide that emotional anchor from these things happening?
Yeah, my guess is other people don't soothe him in the way mom does.
Right.
And I think from some of the things that, Tony, you may read about things mom has said, there was clearly an enmeshment with his mom, and his mom was looking at him through an entirely different lens than the rest of the world. And her presence had a calming effect on him.
Right.
And so I doubt that would be something that would happen out in the general population.
There's another letter, and we're going to get to also what mom said here in a moment. This is the one to the family. And these letters are none of them are long. It's not like we're just reading an excerpt in case somebody's like, where's the rest of it? This is it.
Short.
Dear family, together, hand in hand and galvanized by the wisdom of the singular heart, we triumphantly ascend to new peaks, thus apprehending the beautiful pattern from the labyrinth and path taken. A four, just the word a four, which I find interesting. Indeed, we have traversed many once novel territories, finding that when all else may seem variable and topic, it is the one constant from which clarity and serenity are ever accessible. Love always, Brian B.C. by buddy brother Brian C. Koberger. It's a long signature. I mean, is this just, it's grandiose in nature. Mm-hmm. It's speaking above everybody else. I mean, is that part of what's going on here? He thinks that he's so far above everybody that he's speaking like in really nonsensical ways, but in his mind, it's making sense. He's just that removed from reality and what sensical is and what is just truly madness.
Yeah, I think he's in a different world. He's really in a different world, but grandiose at the same time.
Yeah.
And always has this sense of, look at me, look what I can do, look how special I am.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I looked up too. So I was curious about his only thing he has really access to in there is the Bible. And I actually try to cross reference anything with the Bible that he
doesn't even feel that way. It's just
no, it's not. The only one that comes close is Psalm 32, too. He maketh me lie down in green pastures is the only potential overlap, but it's a stretch.
I almost feel like it's really a really bad corporate memo. Where it's very, very corporate speak, but like to a crazy extent, like it's not even corporate, like the words are prophetic, like, but they're such grandiose forward thinking statements that are just full of fluff and completely devoid of any sort of true meaning. Is there any world in here where this is just all performance by Brian Koberger? I'm wondering if 10 months in when he wrote these things, he was thinking, hey, if I look crazy, maybe they'll go down that road. Was he like trying to put a carrot out there for his attorney to grab onto to go, hey, maybe I'm crazy. I don't know. I mean, let's look at that line of thinking for a moment. Siobhan?
Was he that strategic at that point?
Yeah.
My guess is no, but that's where I think if you could, you know, have access to everything the guy has ever written and mm-hmm. go over it and see, are there patterns here? Is there a deterioration? Is he cogent in other, you know, ways of interacting with people, or is this just getting weirder and weirder? My guess is it's gotten weirder and weirder.
I mean, his previous writings, we've seen, like we saw his teenage writings when he was talking about the visual snow. We've seen some of his college work that he's done. They don't sound a thing like this. We've seen his writings of complaints in prison today, mm-hmm. Where he's complaining about, you know, not getting this or that at the lunch bar. And I mean, and they're competent. They're mm-hmm. competent. They're mm-hmm. they're very narrow focused, but I'm not surprised by that part. But they're not written like this.
Right.
Like, if somebody is in, I mean, could he be going in and out of this level of delusion? Is that something that happens with people that may have a disorder that he may have?
Mm-hmm. He could be going in and out of a disconnected state, you mm-hmm. know, and we don't know to what extent are there other signs that make it look like he's psychotic? We're not, you know, we just don't know because we're not sitting down and talking with him. So in speculating, it could definitely be something that's intensifying for him. And would it have intensified for him even if he were not locked up? Possibly, because he's still in the age range where people who are developing conditions like schizophrenia that cause bizarre behavior and bizarre thinking, he could be developing that. Maybe he had, you know, the vulnerability all along and a lot of the other weird personality traits that we've talked about. Mm-hmm. So it would not surprise me if he were just deteriorating, and it could be something that would have happened to him anyway.
And I agree, Siobhan. I don't think it's performative as well, trying to get out of something. He's not a strategic guy. He's strategic for himself and not like trying to. It just doesn't fit, like you said. It's interesting. My theory, I always try to keep things really, really simple for really dumb people. And he is dumb because I always say dumb in words of emotional intelligence, right? Because mm-hmm. he's so broken. Mm-hmm. He is copycatted everything in his life because he struggles, because when you're at that level of psychopathy, you're an empty shell. And so his level of copying and resynthesizing when he writes papers and stuff, but really it's come from studying others. Mm-hmm. My conjecture, and I'm curious what you both think about, is without access to anything to copy there, he's trying to remember what these people he studied did, because he is actually communicating similarly, but not close enough. Like, he wants to communicate. He doesn't know how to communicate because he's got zero communication skills. He's trying to communicate with his family. He does have a history of writing formally. Even his objections with his status in prison are always pretty formal of how mm-hmm. he's writing. So he's got this formal writing style because he doesn't have empathy. He doesn't know how to communicate mm-hmm. on a personal level. I'm thinking he just doesn't have a good enough memory to copy something down to communicate with his family, because he's just got nothing there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could be very true. And somebody made the comment, which I'm like, yeah, maybe he's been studying poetry while, you know, locked up. And he's just gotten very flowery and is copying that style. So.
Trying to, right. And he can't, because he can't really truly create anything. You're seeing what creation, you're seeing what someone creating, it, someone without any creativity is trying to do. Right.
Yes.
Speaking of Koberger, or speaking of people who may demonstrate this type of behavior, writings like this that just kind of are off the path of anything else they typically do. Does someone like this, and this I'll be pure speculation, we don't know about with Koberger, but is someone who may be going in and out of this way of thinking, when they're out of it, when they're in a more cognitive state, when he's complaining about, you know, bananas and things like that at the people at the prison, when he's in that sort of state, when they look back on this sort of behavior, this sort of writing, do they recollect it? Do they even know they did it? I mean, or is it like such a compartmentalized version of themselves that they're like, if you put it in front of them, they'd be like, I didn't do that.
Good question.
It's a good question. I would say most of the time, I've never seen somebody who didn't.
Okay.
Remember their psychotic, you know, I'm thinking of people who would have episodes, maybe they went off their meds and they became psychotic and they wrote a bunch of crazy shit. And then later on you could show it to them and they can usually say, yes, I remember when I wrote that and I remember what I was thinking at that time. But yes, I'm looking at it differently now. So it's usually not so compartmentalized mm-hmm. that they don't remember doing it.
Yeah. Do you think he'd be able to say, here's what I meant when I wrote that? Or I would be curious about what he, mm-hmm. if he'd be able to say, yeah, I meant this, 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 and this. Mm-hmm. Or he just bleh.
Well, it makes me wonder because it's such a discombobulated way of thinking that he's doing. I mean, it makes me wonder if when the murders occurred, if he was also in this sort of a state and he's thinking he's, you know, by killing the people, it's bringing him closer to whatever insanity mm-hmm. that he's, you know, mm-hmm. conjuring up of mm-hmm. telepathically communicating. Like a four, I thought was interesting, putting the word a four in there because there's four victims. I don't know if that means anything or not, but I mean, and not that he's, I don't think he's trying to communicate in code. I don't think he's bright enough for that.
Right.
But it's just, it makes you wonder, like when he was in that state of doing this to these victims, I mean, was he thinking, you know, his dog's telling him to do it? Or, you know, like are there, it makes you wonder. I mean, it really does. Because if he's capable and this is legit and he's thinking this way over here, who's to say he wasn't in some sort of weird state then too?
Very true. Very true. Very true. It could be something that he's been experiencing for many years and kind of fluctuates with sometimes it's more predominant and other times he can contain it and keep it from, I mean, he obviously wasn't doing this in his, you know, his academic world. He wasn't mm-hmm. writing in this bizarre kind of way. So it could have been something that ebbed and flowed.
Yeah,
but just a rage outlet, though. I mean, that's an interesting scene. I wonder because he doesn't have an outlet for that rage anymore. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, it's been documented all over the place his outbursts he would have and this inner rage, mm-hmm. and then the brutality of what he did to those four beautiful young people. That was a lot of rage coming out there, and without that rage outlet, I wonder, does that affect all this psychotic break potential as well?
Not having an outlet for the rage.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could. It's hard to know what he does with all the emotions he must have at this point.
And obviously not write well.
Yeah, doesn't write well. But is he, you know, what is his fantasy life like now? Does he still think about unaliving people? I would guess that he does. But that would be interesting.
I found it fascinating. Also, it talks about his mother. The night of his arrest, she had no lawyer. She told agents repeatedly, he's my angel. She said he had no anger issues, was never confrontational, didn't hold grudges. She said he had almost no friends. He had a couple of girlfriends, not a lot. He had never lived alone until age 27. He communicated almost exclusively with her and his father. And we've seen that on the call logs and all that. Yeah, that is, it's not her just thinking that. That is pretty much exclusively who he communicated with. When they told her he was charged with four premeditated unalivings, she said, "My son would not do this. I will stake my life on that." And I get, I mean, a mom's not going to think that of it. He's my angel. That's interesting. I mean, I don't know. I mean, some mothers, I guess, would say that. What's your take on that? A mother who's just really so head in the sand on her son, her who she knows is kind of off and kind of odd, but you know, it's he's almost like a puppy to her in some ways. Where it's like, you can do no wrong, even though you pee on the carpet over here, I still love you. I mean, that's how I am with my dog. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, I know you pooped over there and peed and I just let you out, but I still love you. You're still cute. You know, that kind of feels like this. I mean, what's your take on mom?
Mom is not grounded in the reality of who this, you know, this angel really is.
Yeah.
Who she was really raising here. So I would say it's an enmeshed relationship. She didn't want to see, I think, how aberrant he was. And mm-hmm. so she had a lot of empathy for him. And empathy is, of course, a good thing, but sometimes too much can make you blind. Mm-hmm. And I think you had a blind spot here, massive. Yes.
Her and Asa Ellerup need to get together and go to the same counselor, man.
Yes, that they could. You could put them in a group together.
No,
yes,
I'm kidding.
Yeah,
they could start a podcast their two together. Angels. That'd be interesting. Yeah,
could you imagine? Our sons and our husbands are completely innocent. They're angels.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, that's got to be a hard one. I mean, obviously, I do wonder, and I'm not trying to cast any dispersions on mom. She, too, I can't imagine trying to wrap your mind around this.
She's being a mom.
But I imagine there's a lot of looking back on him now going, yeah, there were a lot of red flags, but you don't necessarily see those sometimes when you're that close to the fire. And I wonder about the rest of the dysfunction of the household, not necessarily like in a bad murderous way, but mm-hmm. just odd ways of thinking. Dad mm-hmm. seems to be a little off too, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I don't know how or what or why, but I don't know. He just seems a little not murderous, but you know, mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. If I met him somewhere, I'd be like, not quite sure what's up with him. It makes you wonder. And when you're that close to that kind of whatever it may be going on, it may not be that evident if you're seeing it every damn day, you know?
Right, right. And a lot of people are not objective about their children because, you know, they've got a kid. And you see this with kids who are autistic. You know, the parents mm-hmm. are just really used to them being the way they are. And so they don't necessarily have a very objective view on what's really something that's potentially dangerous or highly problematic here. They don't get their kids the help that they need just because, well, you know, they've always been a little bit different. That's just the way they are. And, mm-hmm. But I hear you. And some of these, if it's a neurodevelopmental condition, which we do look at things like schizophrenia, even psychopathy, we're starting to view that as a neurodevelopmental condition. There are genetic factors involved in that.
Yeah.
So it's possible that there are some hereditary things going on with him.
So say he is going down that road because of his isolation or whatever's causing it. What happens next to him, you know, brain-wise? Does it get worse? How much worse? And what's that worse look like?
I think it's impossible to say at this point. That would be something you'd just have to look for patterns because so much of psychology is just is observing all the different fine behaviors, the small behaviors, and keeping track and then looking for patterns. Is it getting worse? Is it improving? Does it improve under certain conditions? Is there a medication that seems to help? How is sleep related? He's got the obsessive compulsive disorder piece thrown in. And it certainly, I can't think that incarceration is going to help any of his symptoms. Yeah. So certainly over time, it could get worse.
Here's a question I'd love to know the answer to, and none of us have the answer. I wonder what Brian Koberger's bedroom looks like today. Mm-hmm. At home, at mom and dad's mm-hmm. house. Mm-hmm. That would be telling. That would mm-hmm. be telling of how they're handling that. And I don't know how I would handle that if I were in their position. Mm-hmm. But it would be telling. Mm-hmm. just like how Rex's childhood bedroom is handled by Asa, I'm really curious to see how Mom and Dad Koberger are dealing with little Brian's room.
Yeah. And how is Mom, now that he's pleaded guilty, how is Mom thinking of her angel right now?
Yeah.
That would be really important to know.
I venture it's probably pretty similar to Asa's and Rex. You know, that's not the little angel I knew. You know, and maybe bifurcated in a very, very similar way, because mm-hmm. they just cannot accept that's their yeah. little boy.
How would you, what would you say to someone, you know, as a psychotherapist, Siobhan, who, you know, who's accepted that this is the reality of who their loved one is? You can't change that, but the version they knew was not that, and them trying to go forward and live like a semi-healthy and productive life going forward, and not just, you know, burying their head into the sand or a revolver. You know, what would you say to someone to try and make peace with life going forward? Is it healthy for someone like Koberger's mom to really just to live in that world of what she viewed him as, even though it wasn't necessarily accurate, but it wasn't the monster. And mm-hmm. she never experienced that side of the monster. And not that she should sit there and suffer every day of her existence for the sins that he committed, mm-hmm. but is that an okay way to deal with this sort of thing of living essentially kind of in the delusion of what you thought the person was?
You know, I always go back to, people have to survive awful things as best they can. And we're all going to have awful things happen. We're going to survive it in different ways. But I have a bias toward reality. I do think that it's ultimately better for people to be able to look at their loved ones in the whole. And yeah. to understand that there were these other parts that you just didn't understand and you didn't see. And is that a long, lifelong process? That's probably something somebody's going to be working on for the rest of their lives.
Sure.
You know, how do I live with the fact that this child that I adored, that was my angel, was in truth a monster? And yeah. that's it's a hard one, but I tend to think denial does not serve people.
Siobhan, you always give me a new quote every time you're on. I have a bias towards reality. I love that.
If only everyone had a bias towards reality, yeah. you'd be in a much yeah. better
be
state.
Helpful?
It's hard. I admit, folks, it's hard to face reality.
It is.
And we all can go into denial about all kinds of little things. But when it's something that like this, I do think it's better if you try to integrate that this was the complete picture of this person that I love.
Facing what is rather than what we wish it was.
Yeah.
yeah. Dealing with reality on reality's terms. Yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. We'll continue that conversation right there. Let's go over to another case. David Anthony Burke, D4VD, first met Celeste Rivas Hernandez when she was 11 years old. And by 13, the relationship had allegedly become a bit more than just friends. When we hear about an adult allegedly seeking out a child that young, and it's important to understand for the context of this case, he was about 18 at the time too. Still an adult, without a doubt, but not 40 or 50. Still, they would have been in the same school system, essentially, at a point in time. But seeking out a child that young and reportedly maintaining contact for years. Let's talk about that. What does that pattern suggest about intent versus opportunity? Is this someone, because people are going to look at this and you're going to hear 1,000, and I'm not saying they're justified excuses, but I'm already seeing them, of, well, when I was 18, or my grandma was 18, or my mother was 18, or my father was 18, they were dating my mother who was 14, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You hear these stories mm-hmm. and things like that. This is a little further than that. This is mm-hmm. not just like senior and freshman. This is more like senior and seventh grader.
Right.
which is more. I remember being in seventh grade, and I remember having female friends of mine who would brag about their boyfriends who were driving and were 18 and adults. And they were, you know, they thought they were adults. They were down with that. They were like, this is great. And unfortunately, in 1990, whatever that was, five, six, that people were still kind of like, oh, well, okay. It was looked the other way still. Anyway, it's not about me. It's about this. Let's talk about that. That situation there, that age difference and huge. What might have been going on in your thoughts.
Yeah, huge age difference between a 14-year, an 11-year-old, a 15-year-old, a 16-year-old. You know, 11 is definitely a child. That's a prepubescent child. And it speaks of grooming, intentional grooming, and the need for power and control and, you know, somebody that really gains a sense of, you know, what would we say, grandiosity from being able to manipulate someone that young and impress them, which I'm sure he was trying to do.
Yeah, that's even a young age for the Middle Ages, even the 13, 1400s. It was older than that. It was pretty much 14, 15.
Yeah.
And so you can't even have an historical excuse like even Epstein tried on that one. And I think I looked this up the other day. I believe it's 5 years is the difference that they actually talk about legally as well. So it's definitely outside that realm also. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no excuses. And I remember, I'm sorry, having all these talking about our high school years. I remember if you dated someone more than one grade away from you, you got a sideways glance. If you went two grades, that was too much, at least in my school. And, and I'm a hardcore Gen Xer, and we, you know, we're just nuts.
I mean, let me ask this, is there a disconnect that goes on mentally when you're, because David lived in such a world, and he talked about it, where he was online. I mean, the people that he interacted with, at least initially, they're faceless, you know, names on a, you know, with not even real names, you know, they're online names as he's playing games. And if he met her that way, the way that one expresses themselves online, not always necessarily reflective of one's age. Does that play a factor into this in how he viewed her? Obviously when you meet in person, and clearly they'd met in person quite a bit, you know, that should probably wipe that away, going, you're a child. But for some, it doesn't. Does that, in predatory-type situations, does that create a justification in the mind of the predator that this person is just more mature for their age?
It's
In the words of R. Kelly, who wrote Aaliyah's song, age ain't nothing but a number, is that kind of what maybe had been the thought process in somebody like this?
They very much go into that, but this young girl is so mature. I met my first husband when I was 15 and he was 25. And that's what everyone said. I remember when I met his mother, she made the comment to him, well, she's very young, but she's so mature. So mature. And so that's always said, you know, pedophiles with the 5-year-old or the 6-year-old, as I've mentioned before, they'll say, oh, but she was so seductive and so mature
she
at five.
She came on to me.
Yeah. Oh. That's a standard.
Yep.
Why do we see that in society? Is it because we're not far enough removed from our own relatives who've done this sort of shit, where there was that those kind of relationships at young ages, and maybe it didn't turn into a big controversy, and they lived many a years together. Like, well, they were happy till they were 85, and they died, and they married with this kind of an age difference. I don't know, but it seems like the fact that these conversations are had, and people still say that sort of stuff. Well, they're very mature for their age. Mm-hmm. They're still a kid, and why is that not like immediately something that somebody goes and says, yeah, that's not acceptable? I mean, it's one thing to say they're mature for their age in non-sexual ways. You know, if we're talking about, understanding of
of science or math. They're very mature in that area. They've really, you know, they're advanced. Mm-hmm. Maybe advanced is really more the word for that. Not mature. Maturity is something different. Why does society give such a pass and minimize and go into the corner of the predator and not the victim? Is it because people just don't want to deal with the reality of what's directly in front of them and how messy that could be if they call it out?
I think it's changing in society. Yes, we're still seeing it happen, and particularly in some of these, you know, high profile cases, it's awful. Mm-hmm. It's obvious. But there's increasingly multiple states now have made it illegal for girls to marry under 18. And that didn't used to be the case. I mean, there were states where it was legal at 13. And when I married at 16, I did have to go before the court and get permission, which meant sitting for 15 minutes with a social worker, and it was just nonsense. And he wrote the letter to the court saying that I was mature enough to get married. That was in California. But there's a whole movement now, and I forget the name of the organization. I think it's, no, I'm not going to say because I may not get it right, but they're trying legislatively to say it is simply not okay for girls under 18 to be getting married, which I think is a good thing. I think it should be 100%. Illegal. You know, so I think we're becoming more aware that this is exploitation.
Yeah, and we said this the other day too. I absolutely hate people using that excuse of, well, she's mature for her age.
Yeah.
No, so what they saw here, and I think people see, is for someone's age, because they face so much trauma, and just like you, Siobhan, that they become a very good problem solver at a young age. And they mistake the ability to solve problems and stay safe as best they can as maturity. No, they're good problem solvers for their age. I think just be a little more specific on what you're seeing so that you're not making an excuse for some predator out there to say, well, she came on to me. She's mature for her age.
Right.
No, you're dealing with a traumatized child that knew how to make herself safe, and she's a good problem solver, much better than you friggin' nut.
It's a good way to put it.
Riverside County deputies reportedly contacted David in February 24th. So this is before the unaliving. This is before any of this happened, and told him that Celeste was a minor and missing. So they allegedly knew back then that there was a relationship of some sort here. This girl is missing. I mean, if we look at the logs of kind of her coming and going and the videos of where she's been, she was, I guess, I call semi-missing. I don't know, because she was at home sometimes. She wasn't consistently missing. And I think that's a caveat here. Her parents did know where she was from time to time. But she was basically kind of an on and off runaway. So they tell him she's underage. He probably already knows this, but it's on the record now that she's a child. Stay away. Prosecutors then allege that he paid a classmate $1,000. So she's, I guess, in school at this moment, even though she was gone in and out, paid a classmate $1,000 to deliver a new phone to her so they could resume contact. He'd just been put on notice by law enforcement. I mean, what is that alleged choice there reveal about how someone in this psychological space might weigh the risk against control here?
Well, it speaks to grandiosity that he thinks the rules don't apply to him and that he's going to maneuver and get his way. And that, again, is the kind of thinking that we would say is pretty psychopathic thinking, that he wasn't learning anything from experience. And he continued on with his path in a way that indicated he thought he was going to get away with it, as he thought ultimately he was going to get away with everything that he did here.
No guardrails, no accountability, and lunacy that he can throw someone in a trunk of a Tesla and think it's going to be okay and go away.
Yeah.
What a moron.
Yeah.
What do you say here, you know, allegedly happened after Celeste reported death? I mean, it wasn't a single panicked act. This guy, he had a plan, and it went on for weeks, if not months. Tools, bags, a pool, like literally a blow up pool. So he's sitting here thinking, okay, she's dead. What do I do? Oh, let's go on Amazon. Let's buy two chainsaws, a incinerator.
Which is the dumbest thing you can think of in the world.
And a blowout pool. Right. And a kiddie pool. None of this looks weird or anything. And he did it under a fake name, but to his address, with forensic evidence reportedly tying those materials to injuries on Celeste remains. There's pieces of the pool in her parts. I mean, psychologically, what is that kind of, I mean, sustained methodical behavior in the aftermath of a violent act tell you about the person who's able to carry it out?
It says it's a sadistic person who's definitely capable of fairly elaborate planning in his mind, even though he was not very good at it. And clearly he's not the brightest guy. Mm-hmm. Everything he did was stupid, but he was confident and very full of himself. And his apparently he has impressed enough people around him that fed his ego on what a star he is or was going to be. And it's insane that, you know, it's the mark of a predator.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm curious, Siobhan, you know, really focusing on him for a sec. I know when you're dealing with people that are suffering from addiction, alcohol addiction, drug addiction, typically, again, I know this is anecdotal, but when someone actually enters the addiction phase of life, that's kind of where their emotional development stops, like right there. And then when they finally enter recovery, that's when it kicks back off again. So a lot of times they're extremely emotionally immature and stunted because of that addiction. Is that the same thing that happens in cases like this, where you have some psychopath where when it finally hit hold and he actually gets addicted to trying to control someone, like thinking of control as an addiction maybe, or whatever he was doing, because he seems like some five-year-old that watched some cartoon or played a video game on how he went about what he's doing, not someone who's actually making millions of dollars and starting to run an empire.
Right, right. Yeah. Could you look at it as addiction? I don't know. That's not
or
really
the emotional development aspect of it, not the addiction aspect of it.
Emotional development or just being not very smart. You know, you can be artistically talented and still just not very smart.
Right. I want to add on to that, Robin, because I get where you're going. Ego addiction.
And I wonder, is
that a thing, a celebrity, a person who's had a taste of celebrity? They got a little taste of what that life is like, the money, the attention, the you're always right. No one's going to question anything that's going on around you. I mean, it's documented. People were pointing out to him, why does your Tesla smell like death? Leading up to all of this, and his solution, I'm just going to park it out in front of the house and go on tour. Nothing could happen there. I mean, is that the addiction here that drove this sort of, because obviously, you know, you talk about alcohol, you talk about drugs, all this sort of stuff. People do such stupid things when under the influence of those substances, and their addiction is taking over. Is that something, does that explain part of what went on here? An ego addiction, the dopamine hit, the I'm always right, I know what this life is like now, and I'm not going back to being just a nobody anymore. So I'm just going to keep going full forward, no matter what people say to me. People are smelling the body in my frunk. Oh, well, I got a tour to go on. Is that what's driving it? The chemical imbalance that comes with addiction, the imbalance that comes with ego and celebrity and that dopamine hit, is that could be what drove, I mean, these utterly delusional lines of thinking on how he was trying to cover up this crime and thinking he was going to get away with it?
Yeah, you certainly see the grandiosity being extreme. And the other thing that I was going to mention, I heard someone reading quotes from him, and I don't know where he had written this, but things he had written about how much he enjoyed gory, awful horror kinds of media content. And that it had not only desensitized him, and that was his word, it had desensitized him, he thought it was funny. He loved it. And that, I think, is also a piece to look at. You know, of course, there's no direct correlation with people who like gory movies and going out and committing murders. But there is a subset of people, and again, we'd be looking at psychopathic, narcissistic people, who are attracted to that content because that gives them a high. Yeah. And they identify with being in the position of power and being able to commit these kind of horrendous acts on another human being. And that can be something that you can look at as they have a form of addiction to that too. And when we look back at his, as we've done, his song lyrics and the type of videos that he produced, that shows that kind of fantasy life. And even if those videos were done prior to the, you know, the unaliving of Celeste, mm-hmm. He had been thinking about this kind of thing and enjoying this kind of thing. And that's, I think, something that, you know, we need to keep in mind with some of these films. There was a movie my husband wanted to watch the other night, and we got halfway through it, and I just said, I can't watch this. I'm not going to watch torture, mm-hmm. because it wasn't just a violent movie. It wasn't just a movie with graphic scenes. It was about torture, right. And it was a very popular movie, and we didn't know going in that that was going to be the theme of the movie. But there's a certain subset of people who get high off of watching torture and awful things enacted on other human beings. And I have a problem with those kind of films. If I were in charge, they wouldn't be made. I just think there's a population of people that should not see stuff like that.
You know, and I said this yesterday, and I misspoke a little bit. Someone corrected me, and absolutely, you know, kind of relating these psychopathic people to like wolves who will do things for pleasure, you know, like kill for pleasure sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it actually wasn't actually true. The worst animals will do in the wild is they'll kill for territorial disputes and something like and stuff like that.
Yeah.
We are the only organism on this planet, you know, not luckily not all of us, but actually will have individuals that take pleasure in sadism.
Definitely.
We're the only ones. That is just a broken system of our brains in some of us.
Yeah.
And I don't think we know the full results yet of what we're creating with mm-hmm. the world that we have mm-hmm. around us. Because if we look back to, you know, our upbringing, our younger years, you know, we could watch gory movies. You'd have to go to the Blockbuster or whatever and rent it or catch it on television before then. You know, and you were consuming the gory movie then. Mm-hmm. If you have a brain that's just right enough to be wrong and you're doing the murder simulators, video games, and mm-hmm. I'm not an anti-video game person. Mm-hmm. I enjoy a good round of Grand Theft Auto every now and then too. Mm-hmm. But you're participating in it. Mm-hmm. You're not just watching it. You're participating in it. And you can be the most sadistic asshole you want in those games. And there's games far worse than Grand Theft Auto.
Oh, yeah.
Far gorier and far darker and far more disturbing. But you're participating in that. And our brains aren't the greatest at deciphering what's reality in front of us and what's entertainment or what is a simulation, if you will. So I am wondering, you know, how much of a recipe for disaster this was, because obviously millions of kids play video games that are horribly violent and they're not out there murdering. It's not an epidemic where, oh my God, suddenly there's all these murderers. No, there are brains that are able to differentiate the two.
Exactly.
But there's some that are not.
100%. 100%.
There's some that are not.
And some are not.
And that's what I'm wondering, how much of that may have played a factor in the desensitization of David in these younger years that he is still in, where he had the capability to look at it almost like a video game of, okay, here's the task, here's the mission, mm-hmm. I got to get rid of this body, mm-hmm. what do I do? Buy mm-hmm. two chainsaws on Amazon, a burn incinerator, and mm-hmm. a pool. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like something you do on a video game.
Yeah. And it really interesting. I've done a deep dive into research on video games. One of the early books I wrote back in the early 2000s on video game addiction and video game play. And then again, touched on it in the Mass Killers book. Mm-hmm. It's not that there's a relationship. There's no direct causal relationship with video games causing people to go out and commit mass murder or commit. Right. And you do mm-hmm. awful things. But when we look at mass murderers, most of them have been very compulsive game players and played for hours and hours and hours. And they're playing in a qualitatively different way. They're not just seeing this as a game, and they're playing as rehearsal. And some of them have been very open about that, that, you know, they gained skills at what they did when they were became shooters from being shooters in games. And so they played obsessively and they saw it as rehearsal. And they were thinking about how would I act this out when they played. So it's a subset, again, of gamers, and it's the way they're playing. And this has to do with their pre-existing personality problems.
Yeah, I saw that research too, and you're spot on, Siobhan. Your work was great on that. It's, you know, these sadistic trends are already there. It's just throwing kerosene on the fire.
Right.
Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to work our way through the David case. When an alleged crime like the one prosecutors describe in the Celeste Rivas Hernandez case comes to light, one of the hardest questions isn't about the person charged. It's about everyone else. The friends who reportedly saw a young girl at parties and didn't ask questions, or if they did, they just accepted whatever they got. The industry professionals who allegedly kept the machine running. The family members subpoenaed to a grand jury. How do so many people allegedly stand that close to something this dark and reportedly not see it? Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with Robin and myself today as we break down the latest in this case. I mean, let's start right there. We got Burke's manager, Robert Morngroth, who was reportedly overheard telling his attorney that when prosecutors asked, why didn't you call police after learning there was a body in said frunk, said it wasn't his responsibility. His job was making sure the tour succeeded. That's the claim. That's what TMZ claims they overheard in the court hallway right there. So that's the claim. I can't say it's 1,000% factual, but let's just say for a moment it is, because a lot of people seem to look the other way, and that's the gist of this. What happens psychologically when professional loyalty or financial stakes override what most people would see as basic moral obligations? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's where somebody had made the comment, it's kind of a heading toward the Diddy kind of experience, right? Where so many people knew awful things were going on. I think people get intoxicated by fame and by wealth, and they lose all sense of perspective and judgment. And again, where is the empathy and compassion for people that are being victimized? It's just not there. And so you sort of get this psychopathic antisocial system surrounding a celebrity who's doing atrocious things. It affects everybody. I mean, obviously there would be people that would not be okay with that and would have a moral compass and say, hey, this isn't cool. I don't want to be involved here. But many people are just intoxicated by it and they overlook it.
And just look no further than Jim Bob Duggar, addicted to TLC and a whole litany of money he's getting. So he had to overlook his two sons, well, one accused and one convicted of doing horrendous things to children. So, yeah.
I mean, is that why
greed?
You have, I mean, you. I can almost get it from, you know, understanding if you're the person that's profiting, how they keep that motor running, because that's what's driving them. But it's the people around them that I really, and I'm not saying that's right, but it's the people around them that are intoxicated by the celebrity. Is that why people will gravitate still to very toxic individuals who have maybe not even criminal charges against them? Obviously, Jim Bob's never been charged with anything. But is that why people will still get behind folks like that, and the proximity to them? People will still try and get close, even though they know, there's a lot of yuck here. And this is not necessarily, you know, I would choose to be by this person unless they were a celebrity, but people, it's a weird thing, this celebrity thing that people are wanting to get close to. And celebrity is somewhat of a newer thing in our world, in our culture over the last 100 years. I mean, there's always been fame, but to the level and the worship and the desire for connection to just be close to something or someone who is well known, regardless of what it's for, that seems to be an interesting faux pas in our psychology and how we operate.
Yeah, I think it's causing lots of problems. Celebrity worship. Whenever I'm around somebody who's, you know, a semi-famous person, a writer or whatever, and when they have to start name-dropping everybody important that they know, that's an immediate turnoff to me. Mm-hmm. I hate the name dropping. But there's a huge tendency with influencer culture. You know, people want to be seen. They want to be important. And it doesn't speak well of the level of moral development.
So I looked this up, probably trying to remember when it was, a couple of years ago, I think, Tony, on one of the shows we were doing, you know, because when you even look at this, when it comes to convicted serial killers, they get marriage proposals from people.
Yes.
And they want to be selected by people, you know, so it comes down to a few things, I think, and that is people want to feel special if they're not. And so if they're feeling special by someone that is this notorious, the notoriety thing is huge. And this isn't recent. This goes back to, you know, you're talking about the history of just 100 years or whatever. No, as you all know, I read a lot of history.
Yes.
Actually, right now, I'm reading about life, being a time traveler as if you're living in 1300s England right now.
Okay.
And I just got done reading Henry VIII, his biography. The court system, the courtiers, all this was always about who can get closer to the king, who can get closer to the queen. It's always been our society and who we are as a species loves that notoriety. Some people just get so addicted to it. I mean, just look at our political system. Just look at everything.
Yeah.
The Diddy culture. I don't care what it is. You get some people that are feeling, and I'm not labeling people as insecure that want to be around people like this, but maybe. You know, if you have such insecurities that your self-worth is derived from who you know of notoriety, even if they're horrendous people, that's what they gravitate to. And that is the problem. You got to kind of break that trauma cycle in families as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot to be said about the way that David had been portraying himself. Coffendaffer has made a lot of points about it on this case. David would dress in Hello Kitty pajamas. You know, he was dressing like he was a 12-year-old girl sometimes. You know, I guess, and Coffendaffer said immediately, like, it's to make her feel safe, to make young girls feel safe because, oh, he's just like us. He's doing this. And there's no adults in the room going, you're 18, 19, 20, 21, and you're doing this. Why? Why are you dressing like a 12-year-old girl? And it's not an identity thing. It's not I'm identifying as a female and right. I'm a young teen. It was weird. And I don't know, we're in a world right now where no matter how out there you may be compared to societal norms or what has been accepted in the past, seems like everything's off the table. Like, you can do anything you want now. You can dress any way you want, and it's just like, well, that's who they are. And I get it in certain ways, and anybody can do what they want, but at the same point, are we also just turning a blind eye in some ways to really just bizarre predatory-type behavior? Because, well, we just have to accept everybody, and if he's into Hello Kitty, and he's 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old man, that's just A-okay. No, it's not. There's something not right about that, and I don't care what you're, it's not about gender preference or anything. It's there's something, nobody at 19, 20, 21 is going to be psychologically into Hello Kitty, who is a healthy fucking brain.
Right.
Who's dating a 13-year-old.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not, I mean, then there's something not right. And if there's a developmental disability or something, maybe that would explain why you're into child shit like that. But I'm sorry, it's just not a healthy way of thinking, period.
No, I'd say it's not developmentally appropriate.
No.
It's definitely off. Yeah, 100%.
And it's just ignored. It's just like, well, that's what they're doing.
Right.
Burke's parents and brother were all subpoenaed to testify before the grand jury. Court records indicate his mother reportedly managed his business finances, and both parents maintained a close relationship with him. Prosecutors allege Celeste traveled to Texas to meet his family. I mean, without speculating with what anyone knew, because we don't know. They probably did an ID here. I can't think of anybody like, oh, nice girlfriend. Can I see your ID? I don't think that usually happens. If she says she's 19, they're probably going to go with that. But I mean, how does family loyalty or financial dependence on a loved one's success create blind spots that might prevent someone from actually recognizing the warning signs? Do you think that was at play here?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. Families can have just incredible blind spots and not intervene. And that just feeds this kind of psychopathy and the grandiosity when people play into it, when the family, I mean, families are, parents are supposed to correct that kind of behavior, right? That's what, that's the job of a parent.
But when the person you are, your responsibility to correct is also maintaining your lifestyle.
Exactly.
That kind of changes the dynamics a little bit.
Yeah. It's really unfortunate that, that people, I don't know, to me, it just speaks again, it's a lack of moral integrity, the way people can be controlled in that way. And, addicted to fame and the money and using their kids and all the themes that seem to come up in these cases over and over and over again, that they're using their kids, right? They're using their kids.
Because anytime, and we do this on what I'm calling now Self-Help Mondays when it's just Tony and I, right? Talking about families and relationships, you start seeing these patterns and again, I don't know what's going on with these parents, but anytime where you start turning a blind eye because you're placing material gain, you're placing wealth, you're placing all the things that aren't going to matter on your deathbed above the relationships, healthy relationships, how to communicate in a healthy pattern, all these things, you get so, people are getting so addicted to the, I keep saying it, the disease of more and the cult of comparison. I mean, it is just, it is so toxic to our healthy way of thinking to under, to just place things, things that, again, you know, when you look at us as a species, the only thing that has value is when we say it has value. The money in our pockets, the dollars, the credit on our accounts is completely meaningless, except what the value that we place on it is. The only thing is, going back to what is the relationships in our lives. That is the only true thing that gives you pleasure in life. You know, the great studies out there, I know this was done a couple of years ago, so it's not going to be exactly the same number. The happiest people in the world on dollars, I think about 5 years ago, is about $75,000, $85,000 a year. Just enough that you're not in food insecurity and you have a roof over your head, and you have healthy, strong relationships, those are the happy people in the world. It's not the ones that are in that pursuit of more in the cult of comparison.
No.
So it, and so when you see it, you know, all these data points, you know, so David is not, again, innocent until proven guilty. He's not a standalone in this circle around him. He's he might be the focal point, he might be the hub of the wheel, but all those spokes are trying to be up associated with that nutterism. Nutterism, there's the ones for today.
Nutterism. I like that. That's the new cereal that we're going to be putting out. Hidden Killers with Nutterism. Yep. Extra crunchy. Extra protein. Extra protein. Everybody needs protein. All right. That's going to wrap up our conversation for today. Siobhan's book, latest one, Nightbird. It's available wherever you get books. It is
get
her
that book.
Memoir. Go check it out or check out the audiobook. Robin's latest, It's Not All About Me, also available wherever you get books and audiobooks. Go and check it out. Thank you guys so much. Great conversation. And thanks to everybody in the comments today for all of your thoughts and well wishes, thoughts and prayers. your feedback, always very much appreciated. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell, and when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus T&Cs apply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boost and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.